In this episode, we explore how narcissists escalate when the attention shifts to their children.
Welcome to Women Winning Divorce, the podcast helping successful women navigate divorce with dignity so you can protect yourself, your children, and your assets. I'm Heather Quick, founding attorney at Florida Women's Law Group, where women win at life.
This week, we had Hope J and Lynn Catalano on the show, and we had an informative conversation about the psychology of narcissism, how it evolves in family dynamics, and why parenting often brings out more dangerous or chaotic behavior in narcissists. I hope this episode is valuable to anyone who might be listening. Stay tuned for the full episode. Welcome to this week's episode of Women Winning Divorce. I'm Heather Quick, owner and attorney at Florida Women's Law Group. Today, I'm joined once again by Hope J and Lynn Catalano. Hope is a family law attorney with a powerful foundation in social work, and Lynn is a licensed attorney turned transformational speaker who shares her personal experiences with narcissistic abuse. Together, they co-host the Narcissist Slayers podcast and lead the Center for Hope, West New York. Today, Hope, Lynn and I will be discussing the psychology of narcissism, how it evolves in family dynamics, and why parenting often brings out more dangerous or chaotic behavior in narcissists. Welcome to the show, ladies.
Thank you so much for having us again.
We're so thrilled.
Well, yes. So that's always a good sign, right? When you get to be asked back. But I was very excited to have you ladies here and just dive into this a little bit more. So again, for our listeners, if you wouldn't mind sharing a little about yourself and, you know, why you chose to work in family law, just so that our listeners get a little bit of background on you, whoever wants to go first.
Well, you know, for me, I have a background in psychology and my law degree, and I really did not ever practice law. I did a little bit of estates, but I was a professional fundraiser for 20 years. And then I recognized that I had suffered narcissistic abuse. I wrote a book about it. I experienced two toxic workplaces, and I started speaking and coaching people one-on-one. And that has been such an incredible experience. And my path crossed with Hope J. And since then, I have been working with the Center for Hope, which is a center for people who have experienced narcissistic abuse. And we provide a lot of resources for them. And Hope asked me to become part of the Narcissist Slayers. I'm very proud to do that today.
Wonderful. And Hope?
Hi, Heather. So I have a background in social work. I started out working in mental health. And then after I went to law school, my first job it was as an assistant district attorney. And I ended up in the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Bureau, which is where I cut my teeth and started my career in advocacy for women. And when I started my own practice, I've since been practicing predominantly in the family law area, working with survivors of narcissistic abuse. And as Lynn mentioned, I founded the Center for Hope of Western New York, but Lynn has been a huge addition. And, you know, she's the vice president. She's my podcast co-host. And we work together helping victims of narcissistic abuse. That's what we do. Lynn does it as a narcissistic abuse recovery coach, and I do it in the court system.
That's amazing. And I know it. You ladies help so many women. So let's just jump right in. Let's start with a basic definition of narcissism.
So, you know, Heather, I really want to explain that there's a difference between narcissism and NPD. And when we talk about narcissism, it is two narcissistic personality disorder, just as sadness is to depression. And so, you know, everyone has experienced sadness, right? Mm-hmm. But depression's a diagnosable disorder. Same is true for narcissism versus NPD. So a lot of us could experience some levels of narcissism, but narcissistic personality disorder is very, very rigid and firm in its diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So I like to share with you the American Psychiatric Association's verbiage, because as we're all lawyers, we like to defer to the law every time, right? Mm-hmm. So they believe that it is really, it begins in early adulthood, and it's seen in people with at least 5 of the following 9 characteristics. Now, I don't mean to brag, but my narcissist was all 9, okay?
That's an overachiever, Lynn.
Yeah, you know. But you only need 5, really, to be diagnosed, okay? So 1 is an exaggerated sense of self-importance. They expect to be recognized as superior without any matching achievements. 2 is a preoccupation with fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, beauty, or ideal love. 3, believes he or she is special and should only associate with other special high-status people or institutions. 4, they require excessive admiration. 5, they have a strong sense of entitlement. 6, selfishly takes advantage of others to achieve their own ends. 7, lacks empathy or genuine concern for others. 8, is often envious or believes others are envious of them. And 9, shows arrogant, haughty, patronizing, or contemptuous behavior. So I'm sure that we can all identify someone that fills the bill.
And you know, for our conversation today, would you say we're talking about narcissism and you know, certain people have behaviors, but we're not diagnosing anybody, right? We're saying there's levels.
Yes, I do believe, and I believe Hope shares this opinion, that narcissistic personality presents on a spectrum. So, you know, because there's so many different parts to it, some people could exhibit some traits. And certainly that would appear to be more of a narcissism. But guess what? We don't diagnose people. We just assist people and help people who've experienced that type of abuse.
Mm-hmm. And I do think having, you know, laid out the definition, and I would imagine this is your experience. This is my experience in the past. They're telling you their story. They're explaining things that have happened, and we're like, we know what that is, right? Yeah. You just know, because you see those patterns again and again.
Yes.
So we don't have to diagnose anybody, and usually we're not, right? Because they're not the ones in here. We're just helping the individual who clearly has been exposed to that.
And I love that you use the words patterns, because that's what we see. This is never, when you've suffered narcissistic abuse, it's never a one-off. Like, this is not someone did something to you one time and it hurt your feelings. And listen, those things are terrible and we all experience them. Narcissistic abuse is like constant, very slow, deliberate water torture.
Mm-hmm.
It's a drip, 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 drip of you experiencing all these cruel things, all of these intentional manipulations, gaslighting over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I love that you describe it as such. That's fantastic.
So who are some well-known public figures that clearly display narcissistic traits?
We try to stay away from any names because you know how polarizing that can be to our listeners. But I want to tell you that people who suffer from narcissistic personality do seek the spotlight. They are oftentimes in politics, okay? But I think that you see it a lot in celebrity. I think that celebrity is fed constant narcissistic supply. You know, we revere them. We want to know what they're doing. There are paparazzi following them.
Right.
And so there is that entitlement. Like, think about those 9 traits that I gave you from the APA. They have a lot of those, right? Celebrities naturally have that expectation to be VIPs.
Yeah.
I know that Dr. Romney, who is one of our heroes in the business as far as knowing so much, she is the expert on narcissistic personality disorder, narcissism, narcissistic abuse. She wrote a book called Don't You Know Who I Am? And I think that says it right there, doesn't it?
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. Like, how do famous narcissists get away with so much? And like, how do everyday women push back against that same dynamic in private?
Yeah. So I think that is very hard because I think it's a trade-off. Mm-hmm. You're looking at a relationship where that person is famous and you get all the positive stuff that comes along with that.
Right.
But people who suffer from NPD are known to wear a mask so that they behave one way in public and another behind closed doors.
Right.
So that is exactly what these people, that's what you get in that kind of relationship. Just a person might be known to be charismatic and generous, and maybe they're famous on top of that. Well, then you get home and you are treated horribly. Like, that's the trade-off.
I thought that was a really interesting question, because I think that as a society, we are kind of fascinated by that person, mm-hmm. you know, the one who is in power, in a position of power, who's able to kind of manipulate everybody like puppets, who is able to get away with things. When I was talking to Lynn about it earlier, like, one of the people that rose to, for me, who's really personifies that in like the sort of our society's pop culture is Tony Soprano. I mean, I'm rewatching The Sopranos right now, so perhaps I have Tony on my mind. But when you think about that charismatic sociopath, that charismatic guy who manages to essentially escape any kind of consequences, he escapes it in his professional life. He escapes it in his personal life. He manipulates and charms his way through every possible scenario that you can think of. And then when that doesn't work, he obviously uses force and power and violence and, you know, anything and everything that he can do to get what he wants at the expense of everyone else around him. And maybe that's an extreme example, but the thing is that, you know, when you think about it, Tony Soprano is quite a sympathetic figure. People love him, right? They love him. They root for him. They excuse his flaws. You kind of sort of understand why everybody's drawn to him. And that's what happens when you have this level of charisma and power. And you see people with that personality profile often rising in the ranks, right? Mm-hmm. They are in powerful positions in our society. Lynn probably already said this, but you find them in politics. You find them in entertainment. You find them in high positions, for example, sitting on the bench, you know, running corporations. So these are people that have that, you know, there's kind of like forces of nature. Mm-hmm. They are able to, you know, get people to bend to their will. And that's, you know, and also, I mean, the underlying current is that you're afraid to disappoint them. So people really jump through hoops of fire. Of course, you can never really please somebody like this because, you know, they're not. You know, they're really at the root of all of this, a big black hole. Like when you think about Tony Soprano, you know, at the root of his pathology, you know, he was just nothing, you know, underneath it all. He just craved, you know, constant attention, constant admiration, constant adulation. And if you didn't do what he wanted you to do, you were out. Bye bye. Right. So that, again, that's an extreme example, but when you talk about, you know, these sorts of, you know, generally men, but also women who are in these positions of power in you know, in real life, right? Mm-hmm. That's the kind of hold that they have over people. And I think, and also, of course, they always have, not only do they have the charisma and the followers, right? But they also have the funds to steamroll over people. They can hire the most expensive lawyer. You know, they can control their image through social media. Yeah. They can control, you know, other people. If someone gets in their way, they can have them taken out. You know what I mean? And I don't mean in a Tony Soprano kind of way, but there's a lot of other ways to take somebody out. You can cancel culture, you know, all that kind of stuff. Right. So these are people who are there. There are, you know, and you think about it at that level, but even in a smaller level, when this narcissist person with these personality traits is in your life, they may not be, you know, the president of the United States, for example, they might not be at that level, but they are, you know, they are that important and that powerful in your life. And they are able to do all of these kinds of things. And people who are in these intimate relationships with them feel just as powerless because of that dynamic.
So let's talk about, like, for our listeners, because that was a great example. And I think it resonates with people, like, who, you know, if you've ever watched it, right? Because you're like, he's a really bad guy. But yet, you know, the writers have given him these parts of that character that you're kind of still rooting for him, even though you're like, he's a really bad guy.
The cognitive
you almost
is
make
real.
Excuses. Well, he's not that bad because they probably deserved right. it, right?
Right.
You know,
right.
In our you know, fantasy HBO world. So let's talk about how can our listeners, like, how do you learn to spot narcissism early on in dating or if you're already married and, you know, now you're listening. How do we help women see this?
So, Heather, over the years of my practice, I have generated and created a list of 10 red flags that you should look for. And it's funny because I've coached a lot of people in their next chapter so that while we're working through all of the strategies that they need to know about dealing with a high conflict person, which is PC for narcissistic personality disorder, by the way, I give them these 10 red flags so that when they go out there and they start dating again, they should be able to see these things very easily. Okay. And they should see them, you know, after the first date, maybe the second date. And that way they're not committing to a relationship. They're not getting into a relationship. But obviously, they also apply if you're already in a relationship and questioning that as well. Mm-hmm. So number one, this is from the APA list. I only have a couple that cross over. But this is really important because this is a benchmark of all people who suffer from narcissistic personality disorder. They lack empathy completely. So that you'll notice if something hurts, if you don't feel well, they're going to get aggravated with you because you can't do what they need at the time. They're not a caregiver. Okay. So be aware. Number two, they need to have control. I swear on our podcast, Hope and I go back to power and control as the answer to everything when you're dealing with a narcissist, because they are always seeking that, but they need to have control of every situation, every person, everything, you know, every part of the day, they need to control that. Number three, and this one was hard for me to grasp, they lie all the time. They lie so much they believe their own lies. Mm-hmm. And so when you catch them in a lie, be prepared to be punished because they're going to either shut down and give you the silent treatment, or they're going to gaslight you, or whatever they're going to do to take it out on you and turn the tables and make themselves the victim. But they lie all the time. Number four, they don't communicate well or sometimes at all. So a lot of times they expect us to be able to read their mind and do what they want. And if we don't, you know, they get angry, they get upset about that. Number five, they do not like boundaries and they will not respect yours. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't have them. Boundaries are so important. Mm-hmm. So I know you know this, and I'm sure you tell your clients that. I know Hope tells her clients that. You must set boundaries. They're your personal rules and limits. Mm-hmm. No one can tell you they're wrong. Just know your narcissist will not respect them. Six, they are never accountable for their actions. This was the big one for me with identifying that I was dealing with a narcissistic parent. I didn't even realize it, but he would never take accountability. He would never say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hurt you. Like, just not going to happen.
Yeah.
Number seven, they tend to behave one way to some people and others to someone else. So like they wear a mask.
Yeah.
So in public, they're known as this great person. And in private, they're incredibly cruel to those people closest to them. I'm going fast and I'm sorry, but I know we have a lot of ground to cover. Number eight, they like to employ a lot of different tactics to punish you, to punish the people closest to them. So they have a lot in their toolbox, but they're going to use things like the silent treatment, triangulation, and gaslighting. Those are some of their favorite things to do. Number nine, they have an excessive need to be recognized, revered, praised, envied, all of it. And if you get more than them, they will punish you. If just know that that is their oxygen, like they need it. And if they're not getting it from one person, they're going to seek someone else out to get it from.
Mm-hmm.
And number 10, and this was a big one for me, I got to tell you, they always stay in the shallow end of the relationship. So what do I mean by that? They don't know you very well at all. They only ask closed-ended questions. They ask like chocolate or vanilla, but not, you know, what are your goals? What are your dreams? What do you want to be? What do you want to do? So these are non-negotiables. And that's what I tell my clients. You have to go forward knowing that these are non-negotiables for a healthy relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to add, because the question was how to spot it early on. The things that Lynn said are absolutely 1,000% tried and true. But I think that spotting it early on requires a little bit more finesse because they're not going to show you all of that in the very beginning. What you're going to get And this is what women need to be aware of, okay? What you're going to get in those very early stages is you're going to get the love bombing. You're going to get these men who come on really strong, really fast. They want to, you know, whirlwind you. You might get showered with, inundated with affection. They might call you their soulmate, like within a couple of weeks or, you know, a month, they're going to tell you that they're in love with you. They've never met anybody like you. You know, and to Lynn's point about being in the shallow end of the pool, at that, in those early stages, what they're doing is they're studying you. So there's something called narcissistic mirroring. Okay. And what happens is they're going to talk, you know, they're going to be, you're out to dinner, you're on a date. You talk about what you like and, you know, who you are and the things that interest you. And they're going to parrot that back to you. Okay. If you are somebody who enjoys hiking and, you know, outdoors, they're going to be somebody who enjoys hiking in the outdoors. Because what they're doing is they're mirroring what you like, because there's no substance there. They're trying to hook you. This is the hook. And once they've got you, that's when you're going to see the list of things that Lynn just described. But the thing what's that?
I was going to say, the funny thing, Hope, is in my book, when I talk about romantic relationships and identifying, like, what happened to my Prince Charming, I say, when he turns into Tony Soprano after love.
Really?
Oh my God.
Well, you notice that, you know, that they cycle through, and we can tell, you know, we're not going to go deep into it, but they do cycle through go through a cycle of abuse. But when Tony would get into an argument or something with Carmela or any of the number of the, you know, mistresses that he had, what would Tony do? He'd show up with a really extravagant gift. I was just on the episode where he bought her a gorgeous sapphire ring because, you know, he started an affair with somebody else. So, yeah. I mean, this is what they do. They will intermittently love bomb you, okay, is what they do in the beginning to keep you hooked, all right? Yeah.
Okay, so this is the question of the day. Do narcissists know that they're narcissists?
Oh. No, ma'am.
Or if they do, they think it's a good thing, right? Because they could never have anything that would be negative.
Yeah, like I guess Hope and I have this ongoing debate, I would say, over whether what they do is intentional. Now, I want to back up and go back to where it's a personality disorder. It is a cluster B personality disorder. They are disordered. They are not normal in their responses and reactions. But, you know, to quote Taylor Swift, they will never say, I'm the problem, it's me.
Right.
It's just not going to happen. Okay. They're never going to ask you, am I the problem? Did I do that?
Yeah. Did I do something wrong? No,
because remember, they don't take accountability for their actions, but they also have this false sense of self that they are so important and critical to you and to the world and to their town and to their place. Like, they are integral. And if they're not there, nothing's going to work. Mm. And so if they feel that way, like, how could they possibly think something was wrong with them?
Mm-hmm. So interestingly though, like, you know, the question about, do they know they're a narcissist? They don't, that's not even relevant in their world.
Yeah.
If you are a person who's in a relationship with someone like this and you're doing the, you know, you're up all night Googling the behaviors and, you know, you keep seeing narcissistic personality disorder come up on your screen, the last thing that I would recommend that you do is confront this person and say, you know, of this on the computer, and I think you might have NPD, because number one, it's you know, it's like the plexiglass thing, it bounces off of them, and then they're going to use it
against
you as a weapon, and they're going to bring it up in court, and they're suddenly going to realize, I'm going to get some momentum out of this. She's the narcissist. I've seen this happen many, many times.
Yep.
So you have to be very, very careful. There's no point in somebody like this, you know. Like Lynn said, it's a personality disorder. This is not something that can be treated. It is, you know, if you spend some time researching this disorder, it cannot be treated with, you know, it's so funny because Tony's in therapy this entire time, right? He's in therapy with Dr. Melfi. And even Dr. Melfi says at one point, you know, because she's also goes to counseling. She says to her counselor, I've been charmed by a sociopath. Like she has this moment of clarity, right? However many years Tony's in counseling with Dr. Malfi, is she able to change the personality? No, he just gets better at lying to her and, you know, all the stuff. So they use therapy as another stage, right? That's why we always tell people there's no point in going to marriage counseling with somebody like this. I don't think it's relevant. There is one sort of well-known individual. His name is Sam Vanekin. You can look him up. He's a guy who's kind of made a whole name for himself claiming he's a malignant narcissist who knows he's a malignant narcissist. And then he's written some books and blogs and things where he tries to educate people about what it's like to be in the mind of somebody like this. Now, do I believe that? I don't know what I believe. I'm just saying he is out there talking about that kind of stuff. Right. But I would think that somebody, a narcissist with self-awareness is not, I don't think that exists. Yeah.
No. It's a unicorn.
Now, what about, let's talk about what changes or things intensify. Does a narcissist intensify their behavior when they have children? Because I think a lot of our listeners, now, that's when more women, in my experience, then they will really start taking action. They might not do it on for their own behalf, but I think once they have children, it heightens it. It creates, you know, increases the urgency of the situation.
Well, it's the mother bear, mother lion instinct that kicks in, right? Like you might allow yourself to be treated this way, but when you see the damage that it's doing to your children, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's often the only thing that motivates women to leave these kinds of relationships. And when you say do narcissists get worse, or I think crazier was the word you used, I don't think that the pathology is any better or worse. What I think happens is that they had you as their partner, as their sole source of narcissistic supply. So you were, you know, a secure person in their world who is, you know, they're the sun, right? And we're all just orbiting around them. But once a child is born, once a child comes into the mix, guess what? Suddenly, if you are a person who has any maternal instincts, your attention is now going to be devoted to the children. What happens is they're threatened. Their ego is threatened, right? They are no longer getting the 100% of you. So they react the way they always do, like a two-year-old, like a toddler, like, you know, me, 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 me. And they're threatened and they're jealous of their own children. That's what you're seeing.
Yeah.
What ends up happening. And then, of course, it will often spiral into this horrific dynamic where the narcissist will then attempt to use your own children against you. So they poison the minds of these innocent, fragile beings so that they now have these children become weapons. They become weaponized divorces. And it, you know, it's horrible. But I mean, do narcissists truly love their kids? I don't think they're capable of bonding, Heather. I really don't. I think that there's a lot of, you know, the dog and pony show. When they're in family court, they want to be, you know, they know what they're supposed to do and supposed to say. And again, they're on display the same way they are in a therapist's office. They're that way in court as well. They're actors. They're consummate actors. So they know how to act. But are the feelings really there? No. What's important to them is them. They're incapable of putting the interests of their children before themselves. Go ahead, Lynn.
As a child of a narcissist, okay, so my father was definitely completely a malignant narcissist, definitely had NPD, not diagnosed. I know that I don't know that he loved me. I really don't. And the more that I learn and the older I get, I don't know that. I do know that he loved what I did for him. I know that my achievements became his achievements. I know that he was proud of me in the sense that he could brag about it, but not to say to me, good job. So, you know, think about how that affects a child. Like it can be devastating, but here's what I've learned. You really only need one emotionally available parent to come out somewhat normal. Okay. So Hope often asked me after I've described some event or something that happened as how do you seem so well adjusted? Right. So you just need that one parent, because a narcissistic parent is going to manipulate you for whatever they need. They're going to compete with you and they are going to emotionally neglect you because they mm-hmm. don't care. They don't care that much about the child.
Right, right. Well, and I think like what you both were saying, what occurred to me is they care about themselves. And so now you've entered their realm. So how do you make me look? How yes. does this, how right. do what you do affect me? Or how does me, yeah. good parent, make me look like, right? So it's really, it kind of circles around, but at the end of the day, it's all about their image yep. and the way that people are perceiving them and their act, right?
Have you ever heard the terminology? I think it might be Dr. Romney. I can't remember exactly who said it first, but when they talk about relationships and I, again, Tony and Carmela, I think are a perfect example of this. You're a good wife appliance, right? As long as you are working correctly and you are doing and you are functioning in the way that they need you to function, everything's good. And I think children also fulfill like the child appliance, right? Like you see the difference between Meadow and AJ. So Meadow's the high achieving daughter. Meadow's the favorite. She's the, you know, mm-hmm. and you've got AJ who's like the screw up and everything that he does that reflects badly on Tony. And you see the, you know, the different ways that he treats his children. And that's very, very common because narcissists love to split, right? Mm-hmm. So you're going to have like the golden child and you're going to have the black sheep. And it's, you know, it's going to, because they it's not, again, I go back to, I don't, it's a very difficult thing, I think, for people to understand, but narcissists do not bond. They do not love the way that, you know, you experience love. And so if you're projecting that onto somebody like this and expecting that they're going to love the way that you do, you're in for a whole lot of, I think, pain. It's so much better to adjust your expectations as far as what they are actually capable of. And that's the long-term psychological damage, as Lynn can talk about, that, you know, that's one of your questions in here. What's the psychological toll on the child? Yeah. And it's because when you are raised by a parent who the only thing that is important to them is your performance, right? It's not who you are. It's not what matters to you. It's not your needs. You know, you're not allowed to have needs. Your needs are not inconsequential, because the only person who is allowed to have needs in a household with a narcissist is the narcissist, right? So mm-hmm. what do you learn typically is you learn how to be codependent. You learn how to put somebody else always before yourself. You learn how to mm-hmm. understand somebody else's mood. You learn how to manage other people's moods because that's your job, because you want to, you know, hold off an explosive rage storm, or you want to prevent the silent treatment because it's so damaging when you're being treated that way. So really what you learn is how to be a good codependent. And that's why so many women raised, and Lynn again is the exception to this, so many women raised by narcissistic fathers and mothers end up finding a partner like this, because it's mm-hmm. what they know.
So Hope literally just described uh-huh. something that is so unbelievable when we think about it, that you learned all those codependent behaviors as a child.
Yes.
And then you seek that out wow. in a partner because you find comfort in their chaos.
Right.
And that is devastating. Like that's if
yeah.
we're here to break that cycle right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, this is like, this happens, you know, things pop in my head. And so when you're talking about that, so I'm a huge tennis fan. I play tennis, but then I love watching tennis. You know, I was watching Wimbledon, and you watch all these different tournaments. And I really do like sports in general. And I like winners. I like, you know, those amazing people. And you watch, and sometimes I wonder, right, at me with no psychology training, no psychological background whatsoever, but a lot of TV. And this kind of stuff. But, you know, you see those and they're amazing. And then if you hear their stories, you know, often they were taught like you're to perform for that parent to get the love. And, you know, and hey, there's a lot of that goes on with it. But like you see how some they're like machines and they just yeah. they've obviously got the athletic ability, but it's not really replicable. And then I think when things come out in the stories and you're like, wow, that was probably a very, very tough way to grow up versus others who are great winners, but man, it's just different, right? You just right. see the difference because they look a little, they seem a little more human, right? Like, I mean, and I'm thinking like Tiger Woods and like, you know, and then like the Williams sisters or even, you know, those are the only ones where there's been things made about like their parents. And it's like, but they were phenomenal, like the best ever. But boy, that was a cost. Probably not diagnosing, yeah. But like, you know, and that's when you started saying that about like the performance and their learning to do what it takes to get that kind of love and affection. I think Agassi too, I read his book, like similar, you know, like just so hard, so hard.
But Heather, the thing is that you could be, you know, at that level and it's still never going to be enough for somebody like this. They're right, always going to want, right, yes.
They're
going to
always want more, which is what's so devastating.
So you're never going to measure up. It doesn't matter how, because
never enough.
Because they're bottomless. They're bottomless. Yeah. And that's what
people referred to them as a black hole before. That's what she means. Yeah. There's no end.
Yeah.
Because like you keep going and then like, oh, that's great today, but then it's not enough. Like it doesn't carry over, right? Like you got to do it again and again and better and better. All the time.
I played competitive soccer my whole high school career, and by no means was I any kind of star, okay? But I want to tell you, my father came to all my games, and I would always opt to ride the bus home as opposed to riding with him because I knew I was going to hear everything that I did wrong the whole way home. And see, I vowed, my eldest daughter was a Division I golfer. Never would I do that to her. Never, ever, ever, ever. Because that's, you know, you got to break the cycle. You can't be that person again. It was all.
But it really is. It's fascinating. It's so heartbreaking in so many cases. So let's talk about, you know, how you help your child. You're listening to this and you're like, this is my life. So, and you know, the court here in Florida, they're not, I'm sorry, unfortunately, like it's hard to get this stuff in front of them, and they are not going to limit the father's time with the child, because then of course, as we know, he'll fight really hard to get it. Even if we proved this, it just has to go so far. We've gotten close in a lot of cases. But then it's just therapy with the overall goal to get them back together. You know, it is their, you know, if it's their biological father, their father, there's going to be that connection. So how do our listeners, what would you suggest to help them help their kids?
Yeah. It's not just Florida, Heather.
Yeah.
It's all over it's the whole country that takes, you know, I talk to people in all different states, and you know, I hear the same story over and over again. I follow one mom's battle, and I, you know, you see people who have this experience where the protective parent is being punished and kids are being forced into reunification therapy, reunification camps, for God's sakes. I mean, the court doesn't understand the toll that this kind of abuse takes on a child's emotional health, a child's mental health, and oftentimes a child's physical health, right? So, you know, unless you see the trifecta, you know, the kid is having, you know, anxiety attacks, or they're cutting, or they've lost weight, and they're, you know, like they're having manifesting actual physical symptoms in addition to these other symptoms, panic attacks, you know, it really needs to kind of be at a level where you can involve. I just had this conversation with somebody earlier today, where you can involve mental health professionals who can get involved, because unless it's at that level, and I'm sure, Heather, you get this every day in court the same way that I do. I say, if I ever had a dollar for every time I've heard this from a judge, you know, it's the he said, she said, right? Both parties are responsible. You know, this is a high conflict divorce. It's a high conflict. They don't see it as one person's the abuser and the other person is the victim of that abuse. That's where we have been unable to close the educational gap for people involved in the family court system. And I know, Heather, you're out there trying to educate people. Obviously, we're doing it again today. You know, we're out there doing it. There's lots of people out there doing it. But the people who are in family court right now, you know, what my advice is to people is, you know, to try, if you can, to have these third parties involved, because it makes your case more substantial. If you have a counselor, somebody particularly who has, you know, expertise in working with trauma, you know, kids who are experiencing trauma, and they can offer a neutral third party opinion. School counselors often are like the line of first defense here when kids all go to school counselors and or their teachers and or perhaps maybe their coaches or other people who are seeing the decline in the kids' performance and mental health and the anxiety and the, you know, all these kinds of things. But then, of course, as you know, Heather, you have to be able to connect it back to the time that they are spending in their, you know, we're saying father because it's typically the father, it could be the mother, but the time that they're spending in that parent's custody. And that's, you know, I'm in court on a number of cases where I'm in a trial, you know, trying to make that connection that it's, you know, the protective parent, because of course, then you're going to get those flip allegations that the protective parent is trying to alienate the child, right? And this is what we deal with all the time as well. So it's a very difficult place to be. You know, we don't minimize it. That's why we really try to push for the mom, for the protective parent, to really get some support for herself, that she has to, I feel, you know, counseling, a coach like Lynn, a support group like we offer at the Center for Hope of Western New York. By the way, we can work with anybody all over the country. So, and we have financial assistance available for those who qualify. There's my little plug. Okay. But we do have resources available to help you, you know, because you gotta, sometimes you do want to give up. You're financially depleted. You're emotionally depleted. You're not winning in court. You're being told to compromise and to settle and to do all these things. And as attorneys, Heather, sometimes we do have to tell people this. Yeah, well, it's not what we want, but we know we're not going to win it. So it's hard.
Yeah.
I would just add to that, no matter what is going on, and I know how stressful this whole experience is that Hope just described and that both of you represent people going through this, but you must remember to focus on your child and be the safe, consistent parent. Mm-hmm. When it comes down to it, the child will recognize who you are and what you, and now I know that doesn't mean a lot when you're talking about what you guys are talking about and what you're attacking at the legal level. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is children will realize who the narcissistic parent is, and they will recognize you for not talking bad about them, for just being there for them.
Mm-hmm. Being that it may take until adulthood, though, and I think sometimes that's the greatest loss. Yeah. Is that it may take until adulthood. We just interviewed somebody on our podcast, Heather, that the child had been abducted by the father. And, you know, she lost any meaningful relationship with that child during his teen years. But he did finally come back around in his adult years, you know. It can be a rough road.
It really can. And I know for our listeners, like, but that's what you got to hear. We just have to give you the information and then, you know, want them to seek out, if you got, like you said, seek out the resources, seek out the Hope Center somewhere so that you know you're not going crazy and there are people who understand, right? All right. Well, I can't believe it's flown by. As it normally does when I speak with you wonderful ladies, it's so fun. We could go on forever. But before we go, I would love for each of you to weigh in. You know, our show is called Women Winning Divorce. And I would love to know from you, what does winning at life mean to you, to each of you?
Go ahead, Lynn, you go first.
Find your community. Find your people. Right? I think that's really important because you didn't do anything to deserve this and you do not have to do it alone. And so I would tell you, find your people to give you that emotional support and you support each other.
So for me, again, being someone who has survived the implosion of my entire life after a relationship like this and having to rebuild my life and my relationships with my children, who suffered, you know, the effects of the abuse as well. What I would say to people is that, you know, that I feel that finding my, like, purpose, and my purpose turned out to be, you know, turning my pain to power and trying to help other people, to guide them through this, but also finding your peace. Once you get out of this, and your whole life may have been characterized, because if you grew up in a household like this up and down roller coaster ride, you know, all of your life, And it took me into my 50s to really just, I've found a partner who is, you know, not a narcissist. So that, you know, the relationship dynamics are so much more peaceful and stable. And so, you know, it's so nice to not be in that fight or flight feeling that you're in 24 hours, 7 days a week. So, you know, I think that people really need to prioritize their peace, mm-hmm. and to set boundaries with the people in their lives who are going to impact that. And sometimes it means having to end relationships, because as you get healthier, okay, and this is really, really true, as you get healthier, you don't have use for those people anymore, because you want to simplify your life. You don't want the drama anymore. You're not interested in all of that. And it's, and you know, if you're a people pleaser, you probably have had a difficult time setting boundaries. But once you get healthier and learn how to do that, you know, those are the people you want to let go. And you want, mm-hmm. you just want the circle, you know, like Lynn said, the community, the people in your life to be people who support you and that you feel peaceful around.
Well, I agree. I love that. Absolutely. And lastly, ladies, where can our listeners find you each for more information and resources?
LynnCatalano.com. Go to my website. I have lots of free resources, lots and lots of information. So LynnCatalano.com. And please follow me on Instagram and LinkedIn, TikTok, Facebook, all over.
I'm going to plug the organization. So they can also find Lynn or I through the organization. It's the Center for Hope of Western New York. So centerforhopewny.org is where you can go for all, you know, tons of information on recovery from narcissistic abuse. We have resources, not just in Western New York, but all over the country. We have links to, you know, all kinds of things. Our podcast, absolutely follow us. We're on Spotify. We're on YouTube. Lynn and I are the Narcissist Slayers. We're NARC, you can find, I believe we're at NARC Slayers Pod on Instagram, you know, Facebook, LinkedIn, pretty much every social media.
Well, thank you both. We've reached the end of our show today, and I'm just so thankful both to Hope J and Lynn Catalano for joining us to discuss the psychology of narcissism, how it evolves in family dynamics, and why parenting often brings out more dangerous or chaotic behavior in narcissists. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Heather.
Listeners, if you or someone you know in the Northeast Florida area is going through or even thinking about divorce, you're not alone. Taking that first step can feel overwhelming, but it doesn't have to be. Our newsletter is filled with actionable advice tailored to guide you through this process. By signing up, you'll gain the tools to face the unknown with courage and see if we're the right fit to support you during this life-changing time. Don't wait. Click the link in the show notes, fill out the form, and take the first step toward building a brighter future today.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not an advertisement for legal services. The information provided on this podcast is not intended to be legal advice. If you have a legal issue, please contact an attorney in your local jurisdiction. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are solely those of the individuals and do not represent the views or opinions of the firms or organizations with which they are affiliated. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Any editing, reproduction, or redistribution of this podcast for commercial use or monetary gain without the expressed written consent of the podcast's creator is prohibited.